From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with journalist James Conaway. His book, The Kingdom in the Country, compares the romantic image of the Wild West with the modern reality. Also today, I speak with Father Guido Sarducci, the alter ego of comic Don Novello. The father is now a reporter for the Vatican Inquirer. He followed the Pope on his recent visit to America and reports on that visit in a new comedy special. Folk singer Bill Staines performs a couple of songs to mark the change of season, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks at sex and sexism in three current films. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. A few years ago, my guest James Conaway interviewed the controversial Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, for a Washington Post story. When Conaway walked into Watt's office, he experienced an epiphany. The Pentagon may have the power to destroy, but the Interior Department has real estate, millions of prime acres in the West. That public land captured Conaway's imagination, not only because it has been preserved from private ownership, but also because it's the province of American legend, of cowboys, gold miners, gunslingers, and other loners looking for fortune or freedom. Conaway left his Washington Post job and took off for the public lands of the West to see how those legends compare to today's reality. He's written a book titled The Kingdom in the Country, about the inhabitants and the bureaucrats of the land nobody owns. James Conaway has traveled extensively. In 1981, he backpacked within a few hundred miles of the North Pole for a National Geographic story. He grew up in Tennessee, and he's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and The Atlantic, and he's written four other books. James Conaway, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Have you had romantic visions of the Wild West? Did you grow up with romantic visions?
Well, I grew up on the edge of the West, or at least one notion of the West, in Memphis, Tennessee. When I was a teenager, Memphis boasted of having more churches than gas stations, which was not a settling thought for a teenager. I used to dream of escaping to the West, although I didn't really know it, and I never got out there until years later. I lived for a while in California, and I worked in various Western states, but didn't feel that I knew the West the way I wanted to.
Was your image of the West shaped by movies or by something else?
Of course, it was shaped by movies. It was also shaped by my own family that had spent time out there. My father was a wrangler one year just for the heck of it, and his old spurs hung on our wall in Memphis, and just as I hang on my wall today in Washington, and I used to look at them and think that here was a symbol of a man who didn't care much about horses but was interested in escape. And I think that was what really drew me out west.
I'd like to get a sense of the public land that exists now in America. Which states does it cover? And we'll get to the basic rules about it afterwards. Why don't we start with how extensive it is and in which states?
Well, the way it came home to me, which I think would give you a better picture of it, is I went home after I had done an interview with Watt, and I spread a map of public lands on the floor of my living room. And I realized that in the West, we're talking about the 11 intermountain states from the Rocky Mountains extending westward. I realized that a person could travel from Mexico to Canada and seldom have to leave these lands and never get out of sight of them. That, in fact, was the kingdom of the title of my book, The Kingdom in the Country. And it occurred to me that places in Washington State had a great deal in common with places in New Mexico, although they might not know it, that here was an entity that was governed by its own rules, its own regulations, and had its own history. I suspected that it was a repository for what still endured of the notion of the American West, and I set out to find out if that was in fact the case.
What are some of the basic rules about who can use the public land and how it can be used?
Well, the uses of public lands are varied, and the influence of them is vast. The most obvious users are cattlemen and sheepmen who lease parts of the West to run their animals on. Many of the huge ranches that we hear of in the West are, in fact, a small part of private land where the rancher has his house, and vast acreless tracts where he leases to run the animals. Besides that, there's there's timbering, there's mining, and then there's a great deal of illegal activity among it, the stealing of Indian artifacts, which I got into. There's the growing of marijuana on public lands all over the West. And there are those marginal enterprises like all-terrain vehicles that careen around the desert areas that are strictly legal, but the activity is lawless.
Part of the myth of the West is that it was always a refuge for loners, for drifters, for outlaws. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. It's a refuge for what I suppose you could call individualists. There's a lot of talk in the East about individualism, but there are many Easterners who wouldn't know an individual if he was served to them on a cracker. And I was struck most by the variety and the intensity of private life as it is lived either on public lands or as it is influenced by public lands. There were many stories, but there's a man in Wyoming who still makes his living. I call him a gunfighter. He calls himself a range detective. He's a man who has made his reputation with his gun. He could have stepped out of the 1870s. When I found him in a remote part of Wyoming where sheep rustling is still a viable career choice, he was hired by a rancher to more or less defend 30,000 acres. He has had a unique form of job security. As he told me, one ranch hires me and I run the rustlers off and they go next door and then they hire me. It's a quite incredible story, but he demonstrated how fast he was with his gun, first unloading it, then showing how he draws and shoots from the hip, performing a circular motion, a quite fluid experience, quite fast. Then he reloaded his gun and turned as if to go back into the house that he lives, and suddenly the gun was in his hand. It was literally faster than I could see. I saw something in his eyes, these cornflower blue eyes that I had not ever seen in a person's eyes before.
What?
It was a certain implacable, impersonal force that made the hair stand up quite literally on the back of my neck. Then the gun went off with a tremendous crash and a rock about the size of a 50-cent piece, 15 or 20 feet away, jumped up in the air. He had just nicked the upper corner of it, and he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, "Shooting high today," and put the gun back in his holster and went in the house.
This is a fellow named Ed Cantrell, who you write about in The Kingdom and the Country. How did you meet up with him? Hadn't you heard a lot of stories about him before you actually found him?
Yes, I read a story about him being tried for murder in Rock Springs, Wyoming, about a decade before. And there was a newspaper story in a newspaper out west at some point where he had been interviewed, and the person who wrote the interview said something about his being a range detective in the area around Casper, Wyoming, but I could not find him. No one knew where he was. I called his lawyer. I called a person that he had worked for in another part of Wyoming who said, "Ed's a good man, but he likes to work alone." Eventually, somebody came up with an old telephone number of a ranch. I called the number many times. No one ever answered. I found myself in Wyoming doing another aspect of the book, and I said, "What the heck? I think I'll just go there and see if I can find him." And in fact, I did. I lucked out, and he was there, and we spent some time together, during which he showed me how to draw and showed me some of the other techniques that he uses in his business.
So is this a guy who just travels around the public lands looking for business?
Well, he travels around the West, as I said, from one ranch to another, and his job is to discourage people from rustling. Whether or not he actually shoots people doesn't seem to matter. It's really his reputation, and the point being that the West in that sense hasn't changed. Gunfighters always live by their reputation. They got more done and encountered more danger because of what they were reputed to be able to do rather than what they actually did. The power of guns is really what we're talking about, the prevalence of guns in the West. Guns were everywhere. Their import was much greater than the collective muzzle velocity, I think. There are fewer people get shot in the West probably nowadays. the number of people who get shot in relation to the number of guns that exist is really quite minuscule. But here was a person who actually made his living, if not using his gun, with the reputation of what his gun could do. And in that sense, nothing has changed in more than a century of the West.
My guest is journalist James Conaway, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the miners, the wranglers, the cowboys, the bureaucrats, and the gunfighters who live in the public lands in the West. In your book, you suggest that the classic cowboys were closer to 19th century hippies than they ever were to the kind of John Wayne cowboy image that we have. Can I ask you to describe what you mean by that?
Well, cowboys have traditionally done dangerous, dirty, very difficult work. I didn't realize how difficult it was till I took part in a couple of roundups in the West. Probably the best cowboys today and the ones who are engaged in the most dangerous pastime are those who round up wild horses. This is a relatively small band of cowboys. They travel where the wild horses are, which is in the middle of vast tracts of public lands, usually in Nevada. That's the most common state. There are probably 40 or 50,000 wild horses out on the range. They're not easy to catch. You have to be a good rider, but you also have to be able to work in concert with a helicopter, which is used to corral them. The cowboys that I was talking about in the 19th century were people who were willing to take a bedroll and a change of clothes and get on a horse and ride from Texas to Montana. They didn't expect a lot out of life except freedom and the ability to do what they wanted to do. I think these men are like that today. The curious thing is that they are heavily dependent upon, in this case, American Express. The man that I was with owed American Express $50,000. He was living on credit, waiting to get paid for the federal government for all the horses he had rounded up. He and his partner had also wrecked two helicopters within the last 6 months. As he said, that makes the insurance companies real nervous. I asked the pilot how does one go about surviving a helicopter crash? Your chances are not very good, as you probably know. And he said, well, you just sit there and you wait till things stop flying around and then you jump out. So I pass that along in case you ever need it.
Yeah, I hope not. The 40,000 to 50,000 wild horses that you mentioned, I always figured that they were part of the legacy of the Wild West, but the way you explain it in your book, they're actually more of a legacy of the Depression.
Well, they are a legacy in a way of the Wild West. I mean, the horses came here, they came to the West, but they are envisioned by what I call the wild horse lobby, which is an urban phenomenon. It's not a Western rural phenomenon. They are envisioned as descendants of the mounts of the conquistadors, which is not the case. They are the descendants of nags that were turned out during the Depression because people couldn't afford to feed them. They are not, by and large, they are not beautiful animals. They are usually scarred. They fight a lot among themselves. They're not too healthy. They eat a lot more than a cow does. They're destructive to the range. Some of them should indeed exist, I agree, but not 40,000. Also, I don't think that we as American citizens should pay $20 million a year just to preserve them, to put them in feedlots and feed them hay until they drop dead of old age, which is in fact the case. I think they should be usefully employed in some way, even if that means putting them into dog food. This is something that people don't want to hear, and I've been criticized quite a bit about this as being insensitive to the plight of animals. All I'm saying is that the wild horse is a poor symbol of the wild and untrammeled West, and that the people who are supporting them, I think their sentiments are quite good, just misplaced. I wish they would shift their emphasis to the grizzly bear, which is a creature that really needs them and is really the great symbol of what we're talking about here, a place where man's dominion is not complete and where there's still a chance to encounter something in the wilds that is bigger than we are.
So the way you're describing it, a lot of the people who live out in the West resent the groups that have been established to try to preserve the wild horses.
Well, some of them do. The ranchers, of course, don't like to run cows in competition with the horses. In my opinion, the range is overused, whether it's by horses, wild horses, cows, burros, or sheep. The real point I'm making is that people don't realize the competition that exists for a very limited amount of resources in the West, particularly in the arid parts.
So for food, for instance, the horses are grazing on land that the cattlemen and the sheep herders want for their herds.
Yes, that's right. But all of this land, in fact, belongs to us, to you and me. It's a public resource, and it should be, in my opinion, there should be less grazing of all sorts on it. The other point I was going to make was that people in the West have no affection for wild horses by and large. They also, by and large, a lot of them don't have much affection for the grizzly bear. But it's two very different questions, and one of them, in my opinion, is a lot more important symbolically than the other. I'm speaking of the grizz.
Now, while we're on the subject of horses and cowboys, a lot of the cowboys now are using dirt bikes to herd cattle instead of horses.
Well, that's true. Dirt bike ranching is a real phenomenon in the West. I spent some time with a rancher in New Mexico, a fellow I liked quite a bit, although politically we didn't agree on much, but personally we got along quite well. He has not saddled a horse in 5 years. And I asked him one day why he preferred a dirt bike, and he jerked his thumb at his Honda that was parked in the shade of his house and said, "When that thing's setting there, it ain't eating," which I thought was one of the most eloquent descriptions that I'd ever heard.
So, I guess there's as much of a fantasy life around motorcycles as there is around horses, too, don't you think?
Absolutely. There's not much difference there. You spend, I guess the big difference is if you have a dirt bike, as a rancher, you spend a lot less time
grooming it.
that's right, and knowing it. And in fact, I think the person is diminished in the process because the machine is not the same thing. An animal has a personality. Horses are wonderful animals, and I think they lent a great deal to life in the West as we knew it. There are people who, however, who do spend more time on their machines than people ever spent on horses, and I'm talking about those who ride all-terrain vehicles, which are these three-wheeled jobs that will go almost anywhere in the West. These are urbanites who bring these machines out of places like San Diego and Los Angeles and other cities to romp in the wilderness, and they do more damage per square mile probably than anything other than strip mining. They have a culture of their own. They arrive in by the thousands in certain areas of the desert in Southern California. And at night, you cannot believe the matrix of flashing blue, green, red, and yellow lights that cover these sand dunes while thousands of people are competing, driving in all directions. There's no speed limit. There's no direction you can or cannot go in. People are constantly having accidents. There are horrible deaths as a result of this. It also seems to give rise to some sort of strange cultural manifestation whereby people torch public toilets and shoot occasionally Uzis through one another's trailers. It's an inexplicable phenomenon and one that's terrifying but fascinating.
Well, I want to talk more about your travels through the West, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is James Conaway, a journalist who's the author of the new book, The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the West as it is today in the public lands in the West. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist James Conaway is my guest, and he's speaking to us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. We were just talking about all the recreational dirt bikers that come in and tear up the land and all the subsequent battles that ensue around that. You describe in your book constant friction between the ranchers and the recreationalists in the public lands. Do the battles go beyond the dirt bikers who come in?
Oh, yes, I think they do. The dirt bikers often are competing just with the animals and the vegetation in the particular areas they use. Some of these areas are too remote, actually, to run cattle. But the conflicts over public lands are not limited to ranchers and recreationists. They go all the way up to people who strip mine coal in Montana, people who do seismic shooting to discover oil and gas deposits in various national forests. It's really I think it's in the end the question of who owns these lands and how they should be used. And it goes back in history as far as the white man has gone in the history of the West. Some people view the West as a national treasure that should in some ways be preserved. I'm not saying that you should have no development, should have no grazing. That would be foolish. But I think that the West, considering what has happened to the rest of the United States, that it has not had some public land laws to preserve it from development, shows that what we have in the West should be preserved as a national treasure. There are other people historically who have viewed the West as a place to plunder, whether they are miners or ranchers or whatever. And that those two basic positions are the ones that have been at war ever since we've had a West as we know it. They are at war today. You can say there's nothing new about it, but in fact the process has been greatly accelerated by numbers of people who live in the country, by the power of machines, and by the demands for resources and the money it produces. So although it's an old argument and an old battle, it has a certain heightened poignancy now, in my opinion.
Now, I want to ask you briefly about another unusual use that some of the public lands are being put to, and that is the growing of marijuana as a cash crop for the people who plant it. And there are incredible efforts to destroy these marijuana crops. Now, you describe the marijuana crops as being environmentally bad. Would you explain that?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. The marijuana question is much more complicated than people think. Marijuana is grown in great quantities on public lands, often by people who buy land that's adjacent to public lands and move over and grow on the public land so that theoretically they can't be caught. There are parts of the United States, one of which I visited and wrote about in The Kingdom and the Country, which is in Humboldt County in California, where the entire culture is permeated by marijuana. It affects everything from real estate values to what kids buy at the candy store because the kids make money preparing the marijuana for sale. The elected officials, because they are elected, will not arrest anyone for growing marijuana. Consequently, you have the feds who have to come in or feel they have to come in helicopters to try to destroy the source of all revenues in this particular community. It's a fascinating idea. It's the same as visiting a community that would be dependent upon coal or oil or newspapers or whatever. The problem with it is, and I must add that I was in some ways had some respect for the entrepreneurs who would go out and grow this marijuana and then sell it like any other product, but I was dismayed by what they often do to the environment. Marijuana growing today is not It's not as simple as you might imagine. You don't go out and just push a seed into the ground and go and harvest it. They have huge plastic tanks that hold water and fertilizer. They have miles of plastic pipe that bleeds the water and the fertilizer into the plants. They have tons of pesticides that they use to kill wood rats and deer that feed on the marijuana. These animals are killed, and then they're picked up by the raptors and the other things in the food chain, and these pesticides and poisons work themselves all the way down into the trout, into the salmon. So in fact, it's a pervasive thing. Also, a lot of the growers tend to dump their trash because they live in remote areas into the watershed. That also is not good. The thing that dismayed me most, I think, was the fact that children are often used to prepare marijuana and in some cases quite in a quite in, I can't say innocent, but in a sincere manner. There was one marijuana grower I spent time with, saw himself as a small farmer. He did not make a moral distinction between growing marijuana and growing grapes. His kids had their own bank accounts. His kids helped prepare it, or what they call manicure marijuana, during the season, and he felt that it was a legitimate way to live. That was his view. The other manifestations of marijuana growing that I saw was that people would, in this town, would rent motel rooms during the, in fact, this time of year, take their entire crop of marijuana into the motel rooms in plastic bags, spread it around on the floor, turn up the heater and leave for 2 days until it dried out, and then come back and prepare it and sell it. That tells you how pervasive it is in the culture if that sort of thing can happen and the sheriff's office is 200 yards away and they don't do anything about it. That, to me, was a fascinating development.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I'm a little interested in how this trip affected you. After 6 months of being out west and traveling around, living a very itinerant life, you went back home to Washington, D.C. to continue your life in the city. Was it difficult to pick up where you left off in the city?
Yes, it was difficult. Fortunately, I had the book to write, which I did with a great amount of concentration. But the West showed me something that I suspected existed in myself, that was a need to get out of the city and to realize that the West still harbors chances for Americans as it always had. I have to say that writing the book changed my life. The American West changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Well, it made me aware of that there were possibilities beyond what I was doing, that I should look to myself for my own resources, and that I should do the things I want to do rather than what other people tell me to do professionally, which is what, in fact, I've been doing since then.
It's funny, because what you just said is a kind of restatement of what the whole ethic of the West is, a place to do what you want to do and to not have to be told what to do.
Well, I think that's always been important to Americans. I think it still is. You know, the Census Bureau said there was no frontier in 1890. They were unable to find a difference between civilized and uncivilized areas, but I can tell you that there is a frontier still out there.
Did you ever feel like you were in a movie when you were out working with the cowboys?
Well, I didn't, because the country itself is so overpowering that any sort of, I think any medium is going to have a hard time capturing it. I depended upon the written word, which I think is the old-timey one, but in some ways the most appropriate.
James Conaway, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been James Conaway. He's a journalist who spent 6 months traveling through the public lands in the West and writing about the cowboys, the miners, the bureaucrats, the gunfighters who work and live there. My guest has been James Conaway, and his book is called The Kingdom in the Country. He spoke to us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with British mystery writer P.D. James, so I hope you can join us. We're listening to the theme from How the West Was Won, composed by Alfred Newman and performed by the Cincinnati Pops. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Father Guido Sarducci gives his surefire ways to attract the Pope's attention. The father reported on the Pope's recent visit to America for the Vatican Inquirer, and it's the subject of a new comedy special written by the father's alter ego, Don Novello. Also, folk singer Bill Staines performs a couple of songs inspired by autumn, and critic at large Laurie Stone looks at the underlying sexism in three new movies, Fatal Attraction, The Big Easy, and Baby Boom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Stock prices took their biggest one-day plunge in history today. Early unofficial figures show the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 111 points, the second record drop in 3 days. Since Wednesday, the Dow has fallen 255 points. The Reagan administration is discussing its options following the attack on an American-flagged Kuwaiti oil tanker in the Persian Gulf this morning. The Pentagon says 16 people were injured when a missile, believed to have been fired by Iran, hit the tanker Sea Isle City, which was in Kuwaiti waters. The BBC's Alex Kirby has details.
Both Kuwaiti and Western sources say the missile which struck the Sea Isle City was similar to the one which hit a Liberian supertanker early on Thursday, also in Kuwaiti waters. That's widely believed to have been a Chinese-made silkworm missile fired from an Iranian battery in occupied Iraqi territory. Iran has not admitted responsibility for either attack, and President Ali Khamenei, referring to the attack on the Sea Isle City, said where the missile had come from, the Almighty knew better. But the Kuwaiti cabinet accused Iran point-blank of the attack, which it called a grave escalation. Last July, the Americans said they were ready to attack missile sites if Iran showed hostile intent towards vessels flying the Stars and Stripes. But the Secretary of State, Mr. George Shultz, speaking on arrival in Israel, said that while the strike on the Sea Isle City was obviously a serious matter, it was in effect the second attack on Kuwait, reiterating Washington's position that it will not necessarily react to attacks on vessels which are neither in international waters nor under U.S. naval escort when they are hit.
Alex Kirby reporting from Dubai. At the White House, President Reagan declined to discuss possible retaliation. He met with advisors today, and later the White House said no decision has been made. Doctors have found a suspicious lesion in the left breast of First Lady Nancy Reagan. She's scheduled to enter the hospital this evening and to undergo a biopsy early tomorrow morning. If the lesion is cancerous, doctors will perform a modified radical mastectomy, removing her left breast and lymph nodes. White House officials say the First Lady is taking the operation in stride, and so is her husband.
Well, of course, I'm concerned, and so is she. But at the same time, I have great confidence in the medical personnel who are in charge of this case.
President Reagan plans to be at the hospital tomorrow morning while the biopsy is underway. Southern England was battered by winds of up to 110 miles an hour today. 13 people died in the surprise storm, said to be the worst in that part of Britain in centuries. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has details.
Officials have called it the worst disaster in England since World War II. Weather forecasters were caught by surprise, and there was no warning that gale-force winds would sweep the region in the early morning hours. Most of those killed were crushed by falling trees or collapsing chimneys and brick walls. Two crewmen were killed when their container ship capsized at Dover. The Isle of Wight is considered a disaster area. Its crops were destroyed on land, and many high-speed catamarans there for an international race were flung on shore. Most of London, struck by 94-mile-an-hour winds, was entirely blacked out this morning in the worst power disruption ever. Everywhere in the city, trees were uprooted. Kew Gardens lost at least a third of its rare trees, and officials there say it will take at least 20 years for the garden to look as it did yesterday. In Kent, the town of Seven Oaks lost at least six of the giant trees that gave it its name. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
After more than 48 hours trapped in a dry water well in Midland, Texas, 18-month-old Jessica McClure felt the touch of a human hand today. A mining expert working to free her was able to reach through a small hole chipped through the rock and touch her leg. But that hole is still not large enough to get Jessica out. This is NPR in Washington. I'm Ann Bozell.
This is Fresh Air. It's autumn, and people in some parts of the country have already dug themselves out of the first snow. Others are just beginning to assess the woodpile, while others are still enjoying the last days of Indian summer. Folk singer Bill Staines, whose home base is southern New Hampshire, joins us today for our weekly music performance spot. He's going to play a couple of his songs about home and the change of seasons.
I do a lot of songs about traveling around because I do a lot of traveling around, and every once in a while it's nice to sit back and write a song about home, and this is one called Where I Live. Where I live, there is a river, and it freezes with the cold, all except some open water neath the bridge. And the ducks that gather there, black and red, they fill the air, winging in across the pines along the ridge. And in the early morning sun, a silver mare breaks on the run across the fields and out along the little stream. Moving like a winter wind beyond the fence and back again, she loves the time, she's smooth as anything I've seen. And there's a field of winter rye that smells so sweet when it is high and whispers to you so you almost cannot hear. Shining like a satin sea beneath the moon when it is spring, it falls beneath the cutter's blade in middle year. Tree that stands out back, waiting for the falling axe to split its rings and show the secrets deep inside. Years of drought and little growth, and years of good, it's seen them both, but now it's there and waiting only for the fire. And there's a truck that's broken down that I used to take to town until the axle went and I left it there to die. I'll get it fixed, I used to say, but that was back before the day when things got busy and I've never had the time. For where I live, there is a road that's seen me come and seen me go, and taken me so far I thought I'd lost my way. Back to where my life is slow and back to everything I know, back again to where that river slips away. Where I live, there is a road that's seen me come and seen me go, and taken me so far I thought I'd lost my way. But where I live, there is my heart, it won't be long before I start back again to where that river slips away. And where I live, there is my heart, it won't be long before I start back again to where that river slips away. This is a song about changes in the season. It's called October Winds, and it's kind of a collection of images around home for me as we move into the fall season. Tomatoes on my windowsill, well, they go from green to red. Summer in the garden still, but the frost, it's got the bed. We've apples in the presses now, and cider in the pails. The gray geese fly beside the clouds, the hunters have the trails. I tie a red bandana around that old sleepy dog of mine to try and keep her safe and sound from the shotgun pellets whine. My supply of fuel, it's pretty good. We've worked all summer long, and one last robin in the wood has left us with this song. Get out that garden rake, it seems it's in the cars. Let every windblown leafy shake comes down in your backyard. Pull on that old blue woolly coat, that keeps you from the chill. October winds have come to town, the summer's o'er the hill. October winds have come to town, the summer's o'er the hill. There's haystack tie up in the loft, there's feed corn in the bin. The cattle gather round the trough, the crops have all come in. You whisper to yourself alone, Lord, how the seasons fly. When birds have taken wing and flown across the morning sky. Ah, you whisper to yourself alone, Lord, how the seasons fly. When birds have taken wing and flown across the morning sky. Get out that garden rake. It seems it's in the cards that every wind-blown leafy shake comes down in your backyard. Pull on that old blue woolly coat that keeps you from the chill. October winds have come to town, the summer's o'er the hill. October winds have come to town, the summer's o'er the hill.
Bill Stain's latest recording, Wild Wild Heart, is on the Philo label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Father Guido Sarducci, the alter ego of comedian Don Novello. Father Guido became known to TV audiences from appearances on Saturday Night Live as a chain-smoking gossip columnist for a Vatican newspaper. Now Sarducci has his first cable special this month on Cinemax, this time as a TV reporter for the Vatican Inquirer, covering the Pope's recent tour of the United States. Sarducci also followed the Pope when he came here in 1979. These experiences have taught Father Guido Sarducci how to stand out from the crowd and attract the Pope's attention.
One thing you could use to help, which I used, was a Polish flag. You know, if you're carrying a Polish flag, the Pope usually will look at you, maybe even stop and say something. I found people go to see the Pope, and if they happen to be standing across the street like from some Polish folk dancers, you know, dressed in their native costumes, the chances of him looking at your side of the road are mighty slim, you know. So I have tips to people, you know, who are going to see me in the future somewhere. Carry a Polish flag, wear a Polish flag, dress in Polish flag colors. You know, that's one tip. Another one is the Pope all the time always has the local archbishop, a cardinal, whatever, ride with him in Pope Mobile. And usually those fellows stand on his left. So usually it's better on the right. You get a better sight of the Pope.
How did you end up as a papal gossip columnist?
Well, I was, after the seminary, I went to the Marconi School of Broadcasting, which is in Reggio Calabria, Italy. They sent me and this other priest from our class to go into the media. And after I went to Marconi, I worked for Vatican Radio, which is at Vatican. You know, it was started by Guglielmo Marconi, the man who invented the radio.
Mm-hmm.
He built the first radio station at the Vatican, Radio Vatican. And then I worked for a while at a place called Radio Free Vatican, which is a boat. It's docked 2 miles off the coast of Albania. And what we did is we would broadcast to communist countries. And I was out there for about 3 months straight. Was it terrible? You could imagine. You ever work on a boat?
No.
It's not any fun. And that was before tapes, you know, when it get kind of rough, when the needle would not stay on the record, you had to talk all the time. You know, you couldn't even play records. What do you talk about? You haven't, you know, you're on a boat for 3 months. What do you got to say for yourself? You know what I mean?
Well, you could use it as an opportunity to give sermons.
Yeah, but after a couple of, you know, weeks of that, what are you going to, you know what I mean? It kind of wears it thin, if you know what I mean.
So is that how you got into gossip, by having to talk extemporaneously?
Well, fortunately, the boat was docked over very famous sponge grounds. And a lot of celebrities would come there to use the boat to dive for sponges. So that's how I got into it. You know, I would interview them. You know, I said, you could get sponges if you take an interview. And then I started working for L'Osservatore Romano, the Vatican newspaper, as a gossip columnist, also as a astrology columnist. I did that for a while. And then, I'm working, too, with the Vatican Inquirer.
Do you remember when you knew you were called to the priesthood?
I really was not called. I was more like a pushed.
By who?
By the people in the monastery. I was, you know, if you're an orphan in Italy, they don't a lot of times send you to orphanage. They send you to a monastery. If you're a boy, child, or girl, child, you go like to convent school. And when you're growing up there, they don't ask you, you know, you want to be a veterinarian, you want to be an electrician, a dentist, what? They just raise you to be a priest. And first thing you know, it's too late.
Did you ever try to run away?
No, because it was really up high in the mountains. There's no place to run to.
One of the most difficult things, I would imagine, for someone coming of age in a monastery is learning how to cope with sexual desires and those kinds of physical longings. Was that hard for you to do?
Right. It was pretty difficult, I would think, because, you know, it's worse, though, as an adult.
So you're still having a hard time
right,
with that.
Right, right.
Well, what are some of the mental and physical ways of transcending those longings that you've figured out?
Well, you know what I find, you know, with sex, you know, when sex is the least on somebody's mind, what do you think? I think usually the people think about sex the least right after they've had it. Right? And the further you are away from having it, the more you think about it. So for someone who is not allowed to have it, you just think about it all the time, you know?
So the trick then is to have it so that you can not think about having it.
I think that's the trick, but it's not allowed.
Oh, I see. So that's not the trick you've been using?
No, no.
Well, do you take lots of cold showers?
No, no. I don't like cold, nothing. You know.
You have to suffer enough because you don't
have
any sex.
That's right. Then you want to get into a cold shower? Please.
So do you have to cope with a lot of guilt because you have these sexual cravings?
No, I don't cope with it too much of the guilt. You just try to ignore it, you know what I mean? I mean, I think that's pretty much what you try to do. It's very difficult, you know. It's supposed to be a calling to be celibate. I don't know. You know, that's why so many American people... American priest always talking about, you know, married priest, they think it's going to happen. It is no way going to happen in our lifetime. It's going to be years and years away because it just does not make economic sense.
Why not?
Well, you know, for like a priest now, you know, a priest lives in a priest house. Three of them maybe live together. Once you have allowed married priest, you're not going to have one guy's wife living with two other guys, right?
Right.
She's using up all the hot water, washing her hair, you know what I mean? What you're going to need is three different priest houses because they're going to have families. They better have big families. And you could imagine three priest houses, three cars. You know, I mean, it's very expensive. Kids want to go to college. They got to get braces on their teeth. Who's going to pay for that? The priests now make about $7,000 a year. You know, you can't take four kids to McDonald's and that kind of money.
Do you follow the Ten Commandments?
I follow the 20 of them.
20? Is there 20 now?
There are 20. A lot of them were lost.
Which ones were lost?
Wear white after dark
mm-hmm.
was one. Wait a half hour after eating before you go swimming. Whistle while you work. A lot of them. You know, people thought these are just things that their mother told you, but the truth is this was a commandment, and they was lost. There at the Vatican, we know about these things because we have a library and the records, everything.
Let's talk about some of the other current controversies in the church. Would you like to see the Pope sanction birth control?
Sure, I think so. I think that would be smart because people do it anyway, you know. But they're not going to do that either. Not this one. The other one was going to do it, but they got rid of him. John Paul I was his name. He was wonderful. He was going to change everything, but they decided not to wait.
You've been in the United States visiting now. What do you think of the state of the Catholic Church in America?
I think it's in fine shape from what I could see. The bingo is going well. We're thinking of branching out to Kino. There's plans, I don't know if I should say it, about making St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York the top part of it, a casino. I don't know if I want to get into this now, but, you know, it's a very, very valuable property. And we're thinking of adding on a few stores and making a big bingo parlor and then maybe even some slots and a Kino. But it's not nothing nailed down yet.
Well, Father, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Bye-bye, buy bonds. Don't take anything wooden. This is what I used to say on the radio when I signed off, you know. No way, Jose. After a while, crocodile. Bill Haley.
Father Guido Sarducci was played by Don Novello. I played myself. You can see Father Guido this month on his first Cinemax comedy special. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we're following the aftermath of the last attack in the Gulf in which a Kuwaiti tanker with flying a U.S. flag was hit. What the response is so far? Nothing. We'll also be hearing about how the city of Boston used strong state civil rights laws, an activist mayor, and a special police unit to solve its problems of racial violence, and also a news about Mrs. Reagan's biopsy in the morning. She has a lump on her breast, and we'll find out what she's going in for.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Movie roles for women have expanded since the days of the Hollywood starlet, but our critic at large, Laurie Stone, says they're still the good girl and the bad.
By now, you've either seen or heard about the fall blockbuster Fatal Attraction, the movie that straps you down and hurls you through a house of horrors. Adrienne Lynn, who made Flashdance in 9.5 weeks, directs with a no-fat pace. The screenplay by James Dearden taps primitive angst, and the three leads perform like the archetypes they're meant to be. There's Michael Douglas as a briefly philandering lawyer, Glenn Close as his Medusa-coiffed temptress, and Anne Archer as his trusting, beautiful wife. Close is the one who comes on strong and ups the ante from dinner to bed to a weekend. Douglas is attracted and flattered, but even before the weekend is over, he's forced to see the dangerous and pathetic underbelly of her sexual will. She won't let him go. When she can't seduce him again, she tries guilt-mongering him with accusations of being irresponsible. And when that fails, she flies into a vengeful rage, calling him a woman-hating faggot, attacking his property and family. Fatal Attraction is so suspenseful there isn't much time during it to chew on its messages, but they're relentless. The movie paints the city as hell. Close lives in the meatpacking district. It says that good women stay home. Archer, who has only one school-aged child, contentedly busies herself by the hearth. And the movie warns that sex outside marriage will not only kill you, but your nearest and dearest as well. This is a fairy tale for the age of AIDS, if ever there was one, and some critics have given Lynn points for insightfully etching our nightmares. That's like giving Norman Mailer credit for documenting his fossilized grievances against women. Lynn doesn't intend to examine hysteria, but to glom onto it. We're not meant to know how Close feels. We're meant to hate her so much we want to see her dead. Several other recent movies share Fatal Attraction's preoccupations, damning the city, and inevitably its resident minorities, poor people, homosexuals, and freaky-beaky singles, and depicting unmarried working women as deficient in humanity. In The Big Easy, Ellen Barkin plays a woman dedicated to her work but inexperienced about sex. She needs to get laid to become a human being. In Baby Boom, Diane Keaton is a workaholic who requires a kid and a move to the country to straighten her misbegotten ways. It's easy for the audience to dislike these women before their transformations, because they're all rich, and they all spout feminist-sounding lines that are lampooned. Even Close, with her rap about love 'em and leave 'em, men the beasts, suggests a deranged feminist sent round the bend by the failure of her doomed vision. We hardly need a lethal virus to unleash cautionary myths about women's sexual appetite, or the evils of free-flying libido, or the protecting sanctities of the family. But we are living amid a pitiless, mysterious plague, and hysteria is rampant. In the age of AIDS, it's healthy to keep track of which women are being branded dreadful and deviant, and who feels licensed to attack them.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with film critic Leonard Maltin, who reports on movies for Entertainment Tonight. He has a new edition of his TV Movies and Video Guide with over 17,000 listings. It's considered the most complete book of its kind. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Days Away, the new album by singer Cassandra Wilson. And TV critic David Bianculli will preview the HBO concert special of Billy Joel's recent performances in Leningrad. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.